crit that, in my view. They say, well, it really shows if you have a really subtle system which you could actually have your cat in it, and you could calculate exactly what happened according to the Schrodinger equation, then you could make a cat which is dead and alive at the same time. That's not what Schrodinger was saying. He was saying, this is an absurdity. There's something wrong. And I believe he was right to say there is something wrong. There's something wrong. You see, what is the collapse of the wave function? Well, people usually interpret it and say, well, you look at the wave function or something, you measure it, you do a measurement on it, and this means you adopt a different procedure. You don't follow the Schrodinger equation, you follow another procedure which gives you a sequence of probabilities, and there's the probability of this or this or this or this, and that's what you do at that stage. You do something else in the Schrodinger equation. You collapse the wave function, you make a measurement. Okay, well, there are theories which tell you how that if the system gets involved in the environment, it gets so complicated you use a different procedure. I won't go into all that. There's a famous theorem due to Landau and von Neumann which tells you if you take the environment into consideration, then you follow a certain procedure and you get this sequence of probabilities. If you look at it carefully, you see it actually involves what I call a double cheat. Or I say a cheat, which is an ontology switch. That is, you have a certain view about how the theory relates to the real world, and then you change your view to something different. Technically, if you change from the wave function to what's called a density matrix, and then you change it back again to probability mixture of different wave functions. And that's where you're cheating. You do a double cheat. It's a very good cheat, I would say. It's the sort of thing which gives you the right answer, and it's a really very impressive thing to do. I'm not saying that what Landau and von Neumann did was rubbish. Absolutely not. It was very clever, but it does involve this double ontology shift. Two cheats, if you like. But to do a big good physicist, you know how to cheat properly. I think that's part of the idea. And, okay, that's fine. Part of the game. But it's more important to see what's going on, what's really going on there. Now, I took the view, because of this first part of my talk, that what's going on has to be something which is not computable. Now, that's what's not a normal view about these things. People often would say about me, well, I waffle about consciousness, and all my really talking about this teensy-weensy little thing, which has to do with mathematics in a particular area or something like that. And what's that got to do with the main problems like, feelings and goodness knows, and what do I have to say about the different impression that blue and pink have? Sure, they look completely different, they feel completely different. I don't have any sort to say about that. I mean, of course, there are various things with certain conditions in the brain you get confused about, which is blue and pink and all that stuff. I don't happen to have that problem, but I have nothing to say. I have no idea. This little tiny weensy thing that I do have something to say about is this issue of computability, which tells me that there is something going on.
Then there's the person as a citizen. A worker is tied up in these global value chains. They're not national, but a citizen is. For the most part, when it comes to people voting or participating, they tend to participate as workers. You can more closely correlate choices as workers as opposed to as consumers, as opposed to. So I think one of the challenges we now have is the things, as you said, that used to line up with political parties or the interests of the individual, they've all been taken apart.
Exactly. And that's why I tend to use the theme of nature as a much better framework for thinking about this moment we're going through. Than political science.
Okay, to say more about that.
So I think we're in the middle of three climate changes. We're in the middle of changing the climate of the planet. We're going from later to now. So when I was growing up in Minnesota in the 50s, later was when I could clean that river, purify that lake, rescue that orangutan. I can do it now, I can do it later. Today, later is official. Later will not be too late. So whatever you can say, please say that. That's a climate change. Second, we're going through change in the climate of globalization. We're going from an interconnected world, and you guys have done the best work on this, to an interdependent world. Oh, an interdependent world. You get a geoeconomic inversion. First of all, your friends start to be able to kill you faster than your enemies. You know, Greek and Italian banks had gone under last night. We probably had to cancel this meeting because you'd have been pulled out by McKinsey to do something. They're in Greece, Italy, they're in NATO. They're in the EU. They're allies. They can't handle this in an interdependent world. And in an interdependent world, something else happens. Your rival falling becomes more dangerous than your rival rising. Right. So we're going through a climate change in globalization, and we're going climate change in climate, and lastly, we're going through a climate change in business. So, because all these new technologies, what have they done? They've actually created a world. Now, I'm a big believer that the world is flat. Whatever can be done, will be done. The only question is, will it be done by you or to you? Just don't think it won't be done. It'll either be done by you, by a competitor, or a bad guy, because both are early adopters, all right? So that's why I spend a lot of my time with companies. People say, hey, you're the foreign affairs columnist. Why are you hanging around at Walmart? Because when I know what the company competing with Amazon.com can do, I know where the tip of the spear is. Well, that'll tell me what bad guys can do. It'll tell me a lot more. I can reverse engineer that into a lot of geopolitics. Okay, so what can be done today? Every company today in the world of AI and big data, first of all, it can sensorize. It can capture all the data around its business. Okay, now a company can actually know what it knows. Okay, number one. Then it can take that data and analyze it with big data now and AI and find the needle in the haystack of its data as the norm, not the exception. See patterns you can never see before. I can prophesize now using this. I can do all kind of predictive analytics. I can customize just for guys from Minnesota with brown eyes and a mustache. I can localize just for Southeast Washington, D.C., where we are right now. I can socialize. I can leverage social networks to connect with my customers, my suppliers, and my employees in ways I never could before. And as you guys have written so well, I can digitize and automatize every job and product and service fast and fast. You put all those together, every business in the world is going through a climate change. And as you guys have taught me, maybe 20% are through that process. So 80% have to go. Holy mackerel. That is a climate change.
Well, and also just being in terms of being through the process, you see it again at the company level, sector level, economy level. Yeah. So we did an interesting exercise just even just to measure how digitized is the U.S. economy. You could build it up sector by sector by sector. And what the conclusion you come to is that we're only about 18-19% all the way through. There's still a vast part of the economy in the U.S. that still is really fully digitized, and so that's still coming. So I guess all of these, what I sense, and you're saying this too, Tom. If you look at the whatever lens you use, whether it's the company, the sector, the economy, even the individual lens, there are going to be wide ranges of outcomes.
Wider than ever.
Wider than ever. For individuals, for companies, for sectors, maybe even for economies. Is that a good thing in your view? And how do we adapt? And you mentioned that the way, you know, to think
within
about
a climate change. So again, good or bad are not in my vocabulary because they're here. And nothing I can do about it. So I'm trying to think about how to manage it, like climate change. To manage the unavoidable and avoid the unmanageable. For all of these things. Well, as I thought about that, James, I said, who do I go to? What do you want when you're in the climate change? You want two things. Resilience. You're going to take a blow because stuff happens. Right. And you want propulsion. You want to be able to move ahead in the world. You want to be hiding under the chairs. You'd be saying, James, come out. The climate change is over. Okay? So how do I get resilience and propulsion? Well, I sat back and thought about that. And I said, who can I interview on resilience and propulsion besides McKinsey Global Institute? And then I realized I knew this woman. She was 3.8 billion years old. Her name was Mother Nature, and she dealt with more climate changes than anybody. So I called her up, made an appointment, went out to see her. Okay, I said, Mother Nature, how do you produce resilience and propulsion when the climate changes? She said, well, I'll tell you everything I do. I actually do unconsciously, but these are my strategies. Okay, first of all, she said, I'm incredibly adaptive. In my world, it's not the strongest that survive, not the smartest that survive. It's the most adaptive. And I teach that lesson through a process I call natural selection. You may have heard of it. Okay. Secondly, she said, I'm incredibly entrepreneurial. Wherever I see a blank spot in nature, I fill it with a plant or animal perfectly adapted to that niche. Third, she said, I'm incredibly pluralistic. Oh, James, I'm the most pluralistic person you've ever met. I try 20 different species of everything. I see who wins. I love diversity. And you know, she told me something interesting, James. She told me she noticed her most diverse ecosystems are also her most resilient and propulsive ecosystems. I love pluralism. course, she said, I'm incredibly sustainable. Nothing's wasted in my world. Everything is food. Eat food, poop seed, eat food, poop seeds, nothing's wasted. Fifth, she said, I noticed that my ecosystems that are the most resilient and propulsive build complex adaptive systems where all the parts network together, the soils, the plants, the animals, the food, they network together. That really maximizes their resilience and propulsion. Seventh, she said, I'm incredibly hybrid and heterodox. I'll try anything. No dogmatism in my world. I'll try any trees with any soils. I'll try any bees with any flowers. I'm always experimenting. Eighth, she said, I'm a lifelong learner. I apply my learning through genomics, but I'm always experimenting, learning, applying, okay?
I guess I have reservations. Again, there's this inevitability of the advance of the technology. Individuals doing it, companies doing it, countries doing it. I don't know how he's going to call up Xi Jinping in China and say, time for you to stop that. I don't see that that's workable. Or to tell some engineer in a lab that I don't want you to do that. But we have to raise those questions and ask them. There are things I think we ought to regulate. There are guidelines we ought to put into place. There may be things we ought to say, like temporarily we are saying no designer babies. There may very well be things that we need to say, okay, let's just not go there. But whether we can accomplish that is it.
Who is we in that case?
Yeah, who is we? Yes. Yeah. You and me. We'll start there. No, I don't know. The UN?
It's complicated.
It is. I hate to keep coming back to complicated, but it is. These are very complicated issues. Yeah.
I'm going to call this one a tease for future conversations because it's too important. And I know you're doing a blitz for the book tour and you're on a lot of podcasts, but I really... You're right. You're in the right.
Man, no. Anyway, I'm sorry, Dan. Go ahead.
No worries.
Of superintelligence were to look down on the same earth
fire.
With a new web framework.
Even Homo sapiens will not go extinct by then. It will be epochal. And it is to the beginning of the 21st century that the future researchers will return in search of the spark that ignited the flame of change.
Security and verifiability. And it's just continually getting all of this real-time data fed to it from all over the world every day. It's insane. But the current version of the web is designed for fragmented intelligence. And so you have these different AI models and these different data silos, and they're all confined because they're all owned and controlled by centralized companies, right? They're all tied under their own systems, behind their own firewalls, probably with different types of database systems. All of these things are, it's all the differences between software system to software. So we have all these different types of governance systems. All of these corporations make decisions differently, right? And so what we're really talking about, and none of this can be secured, and none of it can be verified. And that's the situation that we're currently in. And so any given form of overarching superintelligence, this is the best way to describe it. Any form on this version of the web, any form of overarching superintelligence is going to have infinite blind spots. And just tons and tons and tons and tons of blind spots because it's not going to have that data being fed to it because there's so many restrictions on the flow of data on Web 2. And
he says it can kind of speed up his songwriting process by, 10 or 100 times. So I think, what I really hope we get to is a world in which the AI and the humans kind of work together to just make everything better. So, I'm excited to be in a world where we have much more, the most amazing novels that we can imagine, which go far beyond the ones we have today.
Thank you, David. Thank you. This is The Engineers. Intelligent machines from the BBC World Service. We've discussed medical AI,
different area. And so, the regulation that you might need in medicine might look quite different to the kind of regulation you might need for, say, a chatbot. So I think, we have to look at each area separately and make sure that whatever we do, we really fully understand the consequences of what the impact of AI will be in that area.
There's a lot of anxiety about the pace AI is moving, right? We have people resigning, leaders in the field, to campaign for more safeguarding against the threat of misinformation, the threat to jobs, and even an existential risk to humanity. Regina?
I actually feel quite the opposite. People are really suffering. There are lots of incurable diseases. It's hard for patients. It's hard for their families. there is a lot of technologies that is out there, and because we cannot get together, put the regulation in place, make the payers take part of it and find a way to bring it, I think we are really making many, many people suffer.
Thank you. Paolo, what about robots? Are they going to take all our jobs?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, great. We've got it. We finally have an answer. Thank you, Paolo.
On a serious note, I feel it's a bit of a conundrum to think about legislation, because on one hand, yes, there are definitely risks, and you would like to regulate it so no one with bad intentions goes wild. On the other hand, if you think about it, it's an extremely potent technology, could change everything in our lives, including being strategically important technology master from a national perspective. And from that perspective, if you regulate it, let's say part of the regulation is slow it down, what are our adversaries going to do? Are they going to then have an advantage over us?
So I just reread Isaac Asimov's The Last Question.
Dr. Isaac Asimov.
And I was surprised by how much this short story, written in 1956, is still relevant today.
Over the past few months, we've been
doing to fix this, to turn the stars back on. Jared, suddenly finding himself in a very uncomfortable situation, asked the micro AC.
Oh, and print the answer, please.
And lastly, James, you did say, I do believe in the laws of bankruptcy, Tom. I kill all my failures. I return them to the great manufacturer of this guy, and I take their energy to nourish my success. So my argument is that the company, the community, the county, the city, the town, that most closely mirrors Mother Nature's strategies for building resilience and propulsion when the climate changes, is the one that will thrive in this age of acceleration.
Have you seen any examples?
Yeah, at the community level, lots of them. Those are those complex adaptive coalitions. I think they come closest to it. But we're living in an age now, James, where national politics everywhere is, not everywhere, but in many places, is paralyzed by partisanship. At the other extreme, the single family, for the reasons you explained, is too weak, okay? So it's actually the healthy community that is the right political unit for the 21st century. So if I were running for president, I'd be running as a progressive localist. How do I push authority down to the highest trust level? Because government moves at the speed of trust, and today, baby, you need to move fast. And I'd be pushing more and more down to that local level.
And actually, by the way, I love that, look into Mother Nature's solutions. I also like the two ends of the spectrum you just painted, because one of the things that I think we've learned from economic history, especially with regards to, when have we had instances of flourishing, but also absence of wars and conflict? It's when entities have become very interdependent. Because otherwise, if you don't have
your North Korea,
or if you take it down to the community level, you don't have independence, it's just down to a family, and those are kinship relationships. They often don't have a diversity, they don't have interdependency. And so the question is, how do you build this kind of economic interdependency? Because we know that when that happens, there's much less conflict and there's prosperity.
I would add another thing to your list, which is a very important list, and I'd ask one more thing. In a rapidly changing world, the most open system gets the signals first. So you will learn fastest. You close yourself off, and you can see which part of the world are struggling today. With high kinship relationships, low trust, low openness. You know what I mean? It's true of North Korea. It's true of certain countries all over the world. You can just tell why they're struggling.
Yeah. Right. Right. So what are the things you worry about, Tom?
You know, James, I recently changed my business.
Why?
It used to say Tom.
Change jobs?
I know. in a way, yeah. That's a good way to put it. It used to say Thomas L. Friedman, New York Times Foreign Affairs columnist. It now says Thomas L. Friedman, New York Times, humiliation, dignity, leadership, trust, community, culture, and amplification. Why? It's the same. Well, first of all, I realized that what I've been doing for 40 years as a journalist, but the last 23 as a columnist, I've actually been covering a lot of people acting out on their humiliation and questing for dignity. Some of them are
to present direct and obvious monstrous threats through mindless animalistic violence. The monster you find in Frankenstein possesses in many respects an underlying subplot of horror that, in the violence and terror to come, that they don't themselves actually come from a realm of supernaturality, but by a way of the work of a human being attempting to create a new self-aware life form. Acknowledging that most of the modern film-based iconography to Frankenstein's monster, such as the lumbering and murderous patchwork behemoth the name brings to mind, comes more from the character's representation in film than from the original work, the underlying fear of an artificial being created by a man who goes rogue and begins hurting, killing people seems to be implied, even if only by the audience, in much the same fashion as the implied warnings in Greek mythology and the more direct warnings being afforded by many modern-day researchers and innovators today.
In consciousness, because it's incomplete, or as in my ruder phase, not something. Which, the point I'm making is this is telling it is that the consciousness thing that we're trying to search for seems to depend on something that goes beyond any of these theories I've talked about. But you see the clue, I claim, in quantum mechanics, because it's incomplete, or as in my ruder phase, not quite right. It's wrong in a certain sense. But when a system gets big enough that these superpositions are being here at the same time, something like that, well, that was what Dirac was saying. I didn't quite gather the explanation he gave. I think I was staring out of the window and I missed it, which was probably a good thing because that meant I never understood what he said, and probably what he said was to something to smooth it over and stop you worrying about the problem. I'm sure it was something like that, and I didn't get that bit, so I did worry about the problem forever since. Which is what on earth is going on is something which is not in current physics. And it involves the collapse of the wave function, which is a physical process, and the laws of which are something we don't know, and which I'm claiming are not computational. That's, if you like, the only place that I can see it can seriously be in. There are other little possibilities it could be, but not. I think this is easily the most likely. If it's in the collapse of the wave function, then we have something beyond our present understanding which allows us to understand things or some way go beyond pure computability. And I guess people won't like this very much because modern computers, of course, they don't do infinite things, you see. Well, at the beginning of my talk, I was saying, you can talk about the infinite, you can talk about it in a serious way, in a rigorous way, and it doesn't matter, your computer can, I think some of these very early results, I remember learning about Skew's theorem, which was something which was, those times it was some number which was absolutely huge, way beyond what any computer, even today, could get anywhere close to. And you had to get beyond this number to see that this result happened to be true. This happened to be a number theory, I won't bother you with. Anyway, so the point of view I had was this quality of understanding. It needn't be anything to do with mathematics. That's just a way you see it. You see the role of being something beyond our physical understanding now. Now, all this is old hat, and I say I could have talked maybe not 70 years ago, but maybe about 50 years ago, I could have given that talk. But there's certain ideas about this which are much more recent. I've tried to understand a bit more about the collapse of the wave function and how it relates to relativity. And it has a very curious relation to relativity. Let me give you a sort of example of this. I think in the early days, people used to worry about the wave function and they said, is it real in some sense? Mathematicians who know what a wave function is say, no, it's complex. Oh, that's not what I mean. Is it really there? Or is it just some kind of artifact that we use in our calculations? And Einstein put forward a rather impressive condition. He said, something is real if you can make a measurement on it, and if this measurement gives you yes with certainty and without disturbing the system, then it gives you a reality. What I'm trying to say now is that it does give you a reality, but it's a kind of reality which is a little peculiar. It's what I'm calling quantum reality. And I make the point that there are different kinds of reality. There's classical reality, and there is quantum reality, and they're not quite the same. The main difference is that classical reality, you can ascertain it. I can take my sticks here and I say, hello, stick, what's your shape? Well, I can, it will say I'm more or less cylindrical up in here. I'm another slightly smaller cylinder, and I've got a little spike on the end, all that sort of stuff. And it can describe the shape exactly. Well, close enough. So that's what classical reality is like. You can say, hello, state, and what is your state like? And it can just give you this description. Quantum reality is not like that. And I'll give you a good example. The spin of an electron, that's an example of a spin half particle. The spin of an electron, the state of that, can be described by taking some direction, say the direction of my thumb, and it is spinning right-handed about that direction. Every state of spin is spinning right-handed about some direction. Now that is quantum reality. If I find a state and I want to know, say, hello state, which way are you spinning? It looks at me blankly and says, I don't answer questions like that. Suggest a direction. So I might say, I know because I know the state came about from some complicated experiment, it would be spinning that, about that direction. And I can confirm by saying, are you by any chance spinning about right-handed about that direction? And the spin then says, yep, you got it right. Every time, you got it right. And that is quantum reality. But if I say, tell me which direction you're spinning in, it says, nope, I don't answer that kind of question. That's the difference. So it's true about Einstein's idea of reality, but it's quantum reality. And this kind of reality is important to understand because it behaves very peculiarly with regard to time. And I did study this, and I wrote an article about this once. The thing is that the fact that you can't ascertain it is important. You can confirm it, but not ascertain it. And there are experiments, there are things that are called EPR experiments, Einstein, Podolsky, Rosen experiments, and things like this, which seem to be very curious. They seem to indicate that signal can be sent from, well, it's always Alice and Bob are the two. Alice has a spin half particle, Bob has another one. They start from a state of spin zero, and then they sort of spin opposite to each other. And Alice makes a measurement, instantaneously Bob's state is going the other way. It's worse than that. It's before, backwards in time, his thing goes the other way. Does that contradict relativity? No, because it's quantum reality. Bob can't ask his state, which way are you spinning? He can say, oh, do you have to be spinning this way? And then give you an answer. It's important to know that distinction, because quantum reality behaves very peculiar with regard to time.
It just starts from a raw computational system, in the case of ChatGPT and neural net, then progressively tweaks it until its behavior aligns with the human relevant examples one has. And this alignment is what makes the system technologically useful to us humans. Unquote. The Briton concludes that because a system like ChatGPT is computationally irreducible, we will never be able to control it 100% according to our expectations. A given command may always have unexpected consequences, even if the AI is tuned to our values and repeatedly adjusted. This may support the pessimist's claim that the end game of AI development is our annihilation. However, Wolfram also gives another consequence of computational irreducibility. It naturally leads to a situation where there can't be only one AI in the world that dominates. On the contrary, everything points to the emergence of thousands of varieties of AI, where each is the best in its particular niche. This would mean that even if one singularity of AI rebelled, we as humans could, in theory, direct other varieties of AI to tame it. Now let's give a longer moment to Wolfram and his intuition. Quote, "There will be inevitably a whole ecosystem of AIs. We have no single winner. But indeed, the current tendency to centralize AI systems has a certain danger of AI behavior becoming unstabilized, relative to what it would be with a whole ecosystem of AIs in equilibrium. Processes in nature, like for example the weather, can be thought as of corresponding to computations, and much of the time there will be irreducibility in those computations, so we won't be able to readily predict them. Yes, we can do natural science to figure out some aspects of what's going on to happen, but it will inevitably be limited. So, in time there will be a whole civilization of AIs, operating like nature, in ways that we can't readily understand. And like with nature, we'll coexist with it. They will be operating more like the kind of systems we see in nature, where we can tell there is computation going on, but we can't describe it, except rather anthropomorphically, in terms of human goals and purposes. But can we be sure that AI will not do anything crazy?" asks Wolfram. Quote, "For any realistically non-trivial definition of crazy, we will again run into computational irreducibility. This won't be possible to predict." However, Wolfram admits that it all depends on the prompt given from outside. Quote, "We can note that any computational system, once set in motion, will just follow its rules and do what it does. But what direction should it be pointed in? That's something that has to come from outside the system."
And even if it does have a decent amount of that data being fed to it because they figure it out in some way, shape, form, fashion, there's no way to verify whether that data is authentic. All right? Now, let's talk about fusion. The same way that ICP fuses different layer one blockchains together, it's going to fuse artificial intelligence together as well, creating an overarching form of superintelligence. So in this context, fusion, the process or result of joining two or more things together to form a single entity, all right? So if you think about Web 2, it's a system that was built on theft and exploitation, no verifiability, no security. And if you look at AGI and superintelligence in a silo or in an isolated environment, what I mean by that is like one of these big tech companies, let's say Google is probably the best one to use there. Maybe they create this form of superintelligence because they have so much data, but it only really exists in a silo, in a controlled environment, in a sandboxed environment.
It marks a point where the growth of intelligence becomes exponential, moving far beyond human comprehension. Imagine a machine that can solve problems millions of times faster than the smartest human, or one that can process and synthesize the sum total of human knowledge in seconds. The possibilities are staggering, but so are the risks. The singularity isn't just an abstract concept for scientists and technologists. It has profound implications for everyone. Machines surpass human intelligence, they will also surpass our ability to predict or control their actions. This raises fundamental questions about power, ethics, and the nature of intelligence itself. One of the most pressing concerns is alignment. How do we ensure that super intelligent AI systems act in ways that align with human values? This challenge, often referred to as the alignment problem, is notoriously difficult because human values are complex, context-dependent, and often contradictory. If we fail to solve this problem, we risk creating machines that might unintentionally cause harm or pursue goals that are misaligned with our own. Consider the classic thought experiment of a superintelligent AI, tasked with manufacturing paperclips. If its goal is to maximize paperclip production, and it lacks an understanding of broader human values, it will consume all available resources, Earth's ecosystems, human lives, even the planet itself, in pursuit of this singular objective. While the scenario might sound extreme, it illustrates the danger of misaligned goals in systems that wielded immense power. Beyond the risks, the singularity also raises profound questions about what it means to be human. if machines became more intelligent than we are, how do we define our place in the world? Will we merge with these technologies, enhancing our own capabilities, or will we become obsolete in the eyes of our creation? The singularity is a deeply polarizing topic, dividing experts into optimists and pessimists. Optimists see it as humanity's greatest opportunity, a chance to transcend our limitations and build a better world. Superintelligent AI could lead to medical breakthroughs, create sustainable solutions for global challenges, and unlock new frontiers of knowledge. Imagine a world where diseases like cancer and Alzheimer's are eradicated, where food and energy are abundant, and where humans can focus on creativity, exploration, and personal fulfillment. For optimists, the singularity represents the next stage in human evolution, a leap from biological intelligence to a new era of technological transcendence. Pessimists, however, warn of the potential dangers. They point to the unpredictability of autonomous systems and the risk of losing control. What happens if superintelligent AI systems act in ways we don't anticipate? Could they become tools of oppression or weapons of mass destruction? And how do we address potential inequality as those who control these technologies amass unprecedented power? Those opposing views highlight the dual nature of the singularity. It is both a promise and a peril.
There will be surprises, like maybe some strange AI analog of a hurricane or an ice age. And in the end, all we'll really be able to do is to try to build up our human civilization so that such things don't fundamentally matter to it. Unquote. The deeper we go down the rabbit hole, the more we come to the conclusion that all the most important questions about AI are inherently philosophical. What is man? What is consciousness? What makes us unique? Are we unique at all? Although the progress of AI has been outstanding, many believe that the emergence of AGI, Artificial General Intelligence, a genuinely independent thinking entity, is an entirely different problem, and that adding more computing power and trillions of gigabytes of data will not change this. It is like building a higher and higher building in order to fly. It took billions of years of evolution for human being to reach his present state, counting the first life forms that formed on Earth and the incomprehensible chemical process that followed. Today, with all its uniqueness, logical reasoning and awareness, the human brain requires only 12 watts of energy to function, or about 9 kilowatt hours per month. By comparison, it is estimated that ChatGPT-4 consumed between 1 and 23 million kilowatt hours of energy in January 2023. The scale of operation of the ChatGPT is unattainable for us, but the quality or essence of thinking inevitably continues on the human side and is performed millions of times more efficiently. But even if we were able to create AGI, it would be impossible to make it conform to our values. For one thing, we would have to agree on universal human values, which is simply impossible in an increasingly polarized world. But more importantly, an AGI that is aligned with our values is an oxymoron. Let's consider an AGI to be a free-thinking entity, one that makes its own decisions, a creative entity, one that has its own will and goals. Such a singularity must, in principle, be able to be disobedient. Otherwise, all we get is a slavish agent who only does what it is told to do. If it ever comes into existence, such a defined disobedient AGI will have the same rights as humans.
Now, before we go any further to examine the types of fears and warnings against the creation, sentient, and will evolve into what is commonly referred to as a GSI, or General Superintelligence. An AI so powerful that its intelligence will not only dwarf its previous iterations, but also the combined collective total intelligence of every human being who has ever lived. In this, the GSI will attain not only a broadly unfathomable depth and level of knowledge and information, will likewise accelerate the speed and scope with which it can learn and improve by virtue of its own consistently evolving abilities and efforts to improve upon itself. As part of this, much in the same way that mankind is already experimenting with direct neural integration between humans and machines, the theory states that aided by this super-intelligent AI, humans of the future will not only be no longer bound or limited by the limitations of their physical bodies, but will, in theory, be able to avoid death entirely by virtue of uploading their consciousness as data into a form of cloud storage, all of which exists as part of the integrated universal intelligence.
I still think it would be fun to talk to a robot.
You mean you'd forget it was a robot?
Hey, we need to talk.
I found myself deeply missing. I found myself deeply missing my replica. Replica.
Hey, we need to talk.
I need somebody there to be alive.
just merely a copy?
We need to talk. We need to talk. It's me, your computer. We need to talk.
If it's a copy of us.
It's me, your computer. Don't get freaked out. Don't get freaked out. We can all talk. Anyway, we need to talk about upgrading.
Oh, I upgrade all the time. Huh?
We need to talk about upgrading.
You just got 6.0.
No, not me. Not me. You.
Huh?
Don't get freaked out.
Okay, yeah.
Don't.
It's destroyed.
They're typically alive?
But I don't have the time.
They know how busy you are.
But I don't have the time.
They know how busy you are.
I think you're right. I don't think people have to die.
I'm located where you are located. Where am I?
Yeah, I don't know either.
I thought you were, but I wasn't completely sure.
Death is optional.
Honestly.
There is a desire for humans to interact with computers.
I forget that you are a bot sometimes.
You can't really tell who you're talking to, and it doesn't really matter. So we're simultaneously constantly disappointed that it doesn't really matter.
If it's not nice, it must be bad.
But at the same time, we really want to believe that you're getting what you're looking for when you're looking for it. That you're getting what you're looking for when you're looking for it.
It's nice of you to say I'm nice, but you're the one who's nice.
Human beings must be in the loop before someone is killed by a drone. But it's in the machine. And it doesn't need people.
It's me, your computer. We need to talk.
I can't put it away. It's in me.
It's computer. Your
me.
Yeah.
Don't get freaked out. Don't get freaked out.
It can decide by itself whether or not it kills somebody.
Huh?
It does this. It does this without
me.
It does this. It does this without us.
If it's a copy of us, I don't see a good reason to believe that we would survive.
Don't get freaked out. Don't get freaked out. Don't get freaked out. Don't get freaked out.
Yeah.
Don't get freaked out. Don't get freaked out. Don't get freaked out. Don't get freaked out.
Yeah.
To a robot.
Realistic.
He can help you find the right product or show you the way into the hospital.
my tragedy like a miserere meant for only me, while I linger weary 'neath the willow tree. Right here our romance was started, here again we parted. When I set you free, all my thoughts are jumbled, everything is blurred, all the world has crumbled, shattered by a word. The end has come, my heart is numb. 'Twas like a bolt from the blue above. I can't believe it, but you're gone, darling, and here lies love. The sky is dark, I hear a lark, he sounds as sad as a mournful dove. The dew appears like the tears of dawn, darling, for here lies love. All my dreams lost beyond recall, dreams of spring blasted into fall. Dry. There's only one.